Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
What do you love about time?
Why am I fascinated with time?
I'm Jennifer Wing, the host of Sound Effect, and this is Woody Sullivan, a retired University of Washington professor and the co-founder of UW's astrobiology program. And he doesn't really answer the question, why does he love time? Instead, Woody starts pondering out loud all of the thoughts and questions he has about time.
Astronomers kind of have that innately in that we deal with long times. The universe is 13.7 billion years old. Well, what does a billion years... I mean, as an astronomer, you can't relate to a billion years, let alone as a civilian, so to speak. What does it mean? But we deal with these huge times. And calendars are another aspect of time, how we keep track of time.
When you look into the origins of the calendar,
why do we have these 12 screwy months? And, you know, why does February only have 28 days? And, you know, why are there 24 hours in a day and 60 seconds in a minute? And then if you get hooked on time, as I have been, I guess, then you find, of course, there's all kinds of other interesting aspects.
Psychological time,
social time, you know, how long is the... in a given society, are you willing to wait in line? Physiological time, you know, the heartbeat, you know, roughly once per second. And that ties in with all of music and dance.
Today on Sound Effect, it's about time. That's the theme. Coming up, we'll enter the world of sundials with Woody Sullivan. We'll hear about one man's race against the clock to get coffee from halfway across the world to Seattle. And we'll learn about what's being done to prevent people with mental illness from waiting for days, weeks, even months in jail for a mental evaluation. It's all ahead on Sound Effect. Let's get back to Professor Woody Sullivan. He is obsessed with the concept of time. And you know this fact, the instant you walk into what he calls his man lodge, this little study behind his North Seattle home, it's full of shelves of books, books with titles like Empires of Time, The Genesis and Evolution of Time, Time, the Familiar Stranger. And there are shelves of small ornate sundials, some that can fit into the palm of your hand. And then across his ceiling is Woody's real masterpiece. It's called a reflection sundial.
Meaning that there's a tiny mirror on a windowsill. The window faces south, so the sun comes across the southern sky. Spot of light goes off that mirror up onto the ceiling. And as the sun goes across the sky, the spot of light will move across the ceiling.
Painted on the ceiling is an intricate and colorful mural with alternating light blue and orange stripes. It looks like the wing of a bat, fully stretched out. Thick red lines dash across the pattern. Roman numerals and astrological symbols sit on its border. All of these images allow Woody to read about 15 different quantities of time.
Such as how many hours until dawn. It can, of course, tell you the time of day and the date. And then you can commemorate things in the date. So I've got lots of personal dates and public ones that are commemorated, such as the Mariners finally getting into the playoffs in 1995. But there are other things like the altitude of the sun, how high it is above the horizon.
Finally, at the base of the mural is a motto. All sundials have short mottos. It's been this way for hundreds of years. Things like...
Every hour injures, the last one kills. Ooh. but they can be more upbeat. And the motto for this one... it's in French, and it is, you and I are nothing without reflection.
Woody fell in love with sundials over 25 years ago when he was a professor at the University of Washington.
We began planning for a new physics astronomy building at the University of Washington, and the architects were asking about different nice amenities that it could have. I tossed out the idea of a sundial. It might be nice, and they liked that. And little did I know that I was veering, you know, it's like getting married, you know, it's hard to remember pre-marriage what life was like. But there was a whole period when I didn't care about sundials, didn't know about them very much. So that got me involved with making this very large one that's on the wall of the Physics Astronomy Building. So most people, when they think of a sundial, think of just a boring horizontal plate with a triangle on the top to cast the shadow, but they can be so much more. They're a combination of science and art and materials and architecture, and there are many, many different kinds that can be on walls, kinds where you yourself can cast your own shadow. There's one well-known one in Gasworks Park that works that way.
We have watches and digital watches. Why do you think we still need to have and appreciate these tools?
We need things that slow us down, that make us contemplate. There's so much in our present world that is doing the opposite. And so they can be beautiful, they can be fascinating, but ultimately, especially with mottos, they can be very contemplative. And you just start thinking about bigger things, such as mortality, such as what does it all mean, such as what is the place of the Earth in the cosmos. And so it just gets you thinking about these kinds of questions. Another way it's been expressed is that the sun is like a pen that is drawing out the passage of time in terms of the shadow. It's a very philosophical thing. I mean, I think that's ultimately really at the core of it, why I like them so much.
Is it frustrating to love sundials so much given where we live in the world?
Well, I haven't told you my great goal. My goal is to make Seattle the sundial capital of North America. If you look at interesting dials, there really is no other metropolitan area that has a lot more than we do. But I love the irony of it, right? But you see, when the sun comes out in the northwest, we go running out. The sun's out. Come on, let's have a picnic. We appreciate it, right? Let's look at the sundial. You know, the sundial in Phoenix, I mean, you know, you avoid the sun.
So let's talk about the sundial tattoo. You are the inventor of a tattoo that is a sundial. Can you explain how you came up with this idea and how does it work?
This project began, maybe it's 3 years ago now, with a graduate student at the University of Washington. And there's was many possible ways to go, but in the end, it turns out that it is a bracelet. I need to show you the bracelet here.
Okay, so you just put something on your wrist that could be an interesting piece of jewelry, but...
Right, it's a ladies' expandable wristband, but rather than the usual watch, we have two things. We have, first of all, a bubble level that allows you to get your arm exactly horizontal, because you can't have a tilted arm. And then we have the thing that casts the shadow, the gnomon, that can slide back and forth. And you slide it back and forth according to the date. And the tattoo is now below this wristband. And then the shadow of the gnomon falls down your arm, and it's the inner part of your forearm, which is flatter. You move your arm around until that shadow goes straight down the pattern here. And when it does go straight down, which you have to estimate by eye, then you read where the tip of the shadow falls, and that might be 2 or 3 inches down your arm, and you read the time. Voila, a working tattoo sundial. And I've got a decal that I put on now and then, and the big decision is, am I really going to, in my advanced age, get a full-up tattoo? I believe that I probably will, but I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, you haven't committed yet, and yet you're the inventor.
Yeah, I haven't committed, but I think I need to.
But before Woody gets that tattoo, he needs to come up with a motto. All of the work that he's done over the last 3 years, creating this sundial tattoo and the bracelet, what he completely forgot about a motto.
God, I've got to have a motto here. I'm thinking about permanently marking my body. And after it was done, someone would say, well, what's the motto? Oh, crap, I forgot the motto. Well, I guess one thing could be, if this body goes, the dial won't work.
To see a picture of the mock-up of Woody's working sundial tattoo, go to our website, knkx.org. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme today is It's About Time. And the next story is about a race against the clock, a race against time. It involves one man, a $16 cup of coffee, and the war in Yemen. Sound Effect contributor Heba Fisher has the story.
We're here tasting some beautiful coffees.
This is 28-year-old Yemeni-American Mokhtar Al-Khanshari.
This is called a coffee cup-in or taste-in.
He loves coffee. He's the first Arab-certified Q grader, the coffee equivalent of a sommelier for wine. And he's the type of man to randomly recite Arabic poetry about coffee. In early April 2015, the Specialty Coffee Association of America hosted an event here in Seattle for buyers from all across the country to sample new coffees. Mokhtar was eager for this event. He had been working towards it for over a year with coffee farmers on the ground in Yemen to get their coffee to a quality he could debut at the Seattle event. So here was the plan. He was going to fly out from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, to Seattle for the event. But then, the world as he knew it changed.
2 days before I was supposed to leave, I remember I woke up and thought it was a wedding next nearby at first. There were anti-aircraft machine guns. This was when the war began.
The UN envoy warning that Yemen is at, quote, the edge of civil war.
But before we get to the war, let's start at the beginning. Mokhtar grew up between the United States and Yemen. At his grandparents' house in Yemen, he remembers his first introduction to coffee, picking the red coffee berries with his grandmother off the dozens of trees in their garden. Years later, something triggered in Mokhtar's mind to revive Yemeni coffee for global markets. And I say revive because while the first coffee berry was discovered in Ethiopia, the art of brewing coffee, as we know it today, originated in Yemen.
In Yemen, there's all these varietals that grow there that nowhere else in the world has. You know, it's amazing the amount of diversity in genetics there.
So at the end of 2013, Mokhtar went to Yemen to visit different coffee farms, just to see, was the coffee he'd find at a quality he could export to the rest of the world?
I ended up going to 32 different regions in Yemen that grew coffee, 1,000-year-old villages, and the people have been living the same way for generations. Just for a moment, time stops. Every time I would go somewhere, I'd bring a stack of coffee with me, a sample from the one area. And, you know, it was like a little part of the room. Eventually, I filled up all the room. Like, this one room was full of coffee bags from different areas.
After several months gathering samples, Mokhtar decided to test their quality. Some came back with really high marks.
I'm making them some of the most expensive and rarest coffees ever.
But for the most part, his coffee samples tested all over the place in quality.
So I realized the way it was picked and processed, all these, there was no protocol, there was no system in place. And so the result would always be random.
So Mokhtar realized there was some work to be done. Over the next year and a half, he went back and forth between Yemen and the U.S., training his coffee farmers to get things up to quality. Now, moving forward to 2015, Mokhtar planned to attend that big coffee conference in Seattle. Buyers from all over the country would be there to sample his coffee. And that's when, 2 days before Mokhtar was set to fly out of Yemen to attend the conference here in Seattle, the Yemeni war began.
We just woke up and there was no more, the war began and there was airstrikes and they bombed both airports. They bombed both ports, so we couldn't leave. We tried contacting the State Department. Their official response was, we can't help you, but we can relay your message to your loved ones via our website. It was like a scary, realization not to know if you were gonna live to see the morning. I remember being afraid of that. It was the first time I really felt afraid. And then, so the morning, I was okay, I have to leave. Next day, I went to Mocha, 7-hour drive.
Mocha is a city in the southwest coast of Yemen.
It's a small little port, no one uses it anymore. It was the first port in the world to commercialize coffee, and that's where the name Mocha comes from, coffee. So I went there, and we were supposed to take a small ship with like 100 passengers from Somalia. The ship wasn't working, there was no diesel, there was airstrikes, and said, we have, instead of a 3-day journey across the Red Sea, you can take a smaller ship. It's like a boat, and it's called a Viper, and it's 1 day only to cross. So I'm like, all right. In my mind, I'm like a Viper, I mean, like a Dodge Viper, like a fast thing, you know, and he meant fiber, like fiberglass. So we get there, and it was like this little boat dinghy. You know, no one leaves land, go on ocean, they have no other choice. And I remember the first thing I asked the guy when he was taking me, I was like, I want my coffee samples. So he gave me like my bag that I had, is like I had a Samsonite bag with coffee samples in it. I still remember, you know, texting my brother and telling my mom and dad I love them before I left on the boat. You know, you're in this giant ocean, it's like these waves crashing on you, and this guy has no like GPS, you don't know, he knows where he's going, you know, and he has one single motor engine. If it dies, you're done, you're stuck. You know, we don't have any food. And so I didn't think of anything. I just thought about like my mother and my father. And seeing them. And then we made it eventually to Djibouti, across the Red Sea.
On April 1st, to be sure he made it to the coffee conference in Seattle on the 11th, Mokhtar traveled 100 miles from Mocha in Yemen to Obok in Djibouti in a tiny fiberglass boat across the Red Sea. He arrived in Djibouti on April 3rd, was detained for a day and a half, and managed to fly out to Kenya. From there, Amsterdam, and finally to Mokhtar's hometown of San Francisco. It was April 7th.
I landed. The next day I made it to Seattle.
He made it, with time to prep for the event on the 11th.
I had the coffee roasted for the event, got to the conference, these tables set up all over this giant room, and it was the most well-attended coffee tasting in the history of that conference.
What were you thinking while you were there? Were you nervous beforehand?
No, I wasn't nervous. I mean, I hadn't processed anything yet. I was still in shock, but I wanted to finish this conference and do well in it. It was like six different tables in the same set, and each table, it was the best cup every table. It had a really explosive taste to it right away. Before you even sip, you can smell like the fruitiness notes on it. Papaya, mango, and it was amazing. Strawberries, you know, it was great coffee. There was a French guy called it my coffee celestial. So I don't know what that means, but all these buyers were there, and it was like, I mean, the price points people were giving me was great. And then
what were some of the price points?
The highest that people ever paid for coffee.
To give you an idea, his coffee sells for $16 a cup of black coffee at Blue Bottle. Since Mokhtar made it to that buying event, it's like the floodgates have opened for him and his coffee brand, Port of Mocha Coffee.
The Blue Bottle sold out within less than 2 months. Our next shipment, it's going to be here in like less than 2 weeks now, and it's going to Slate in Seattle, Quatum in France, in Switzerland, in Asia. Some of the best coffee shops in the world.
Since 2015, Mokhtar has gone back to Yemen and is planning more trips. Most of his family living in Yemen has since left. The Yemeni war is still raging on, making it really difficult to grow and export anything, let alone coffee. But his team is managing. And he's able to pay his farmers some of the highest wages even during the war. And every cup of Port of Mocha coffee ordered comes with Mokhtar's story and the story of Yemen's history in coffee.
That was Sound Effect contributor Heba Fisher. You can hear more of her work on the podcast Kerning Cultures, which tells stories from and about the Middle East. You can find a link on our website, knkx.org. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is It's About Time. And in local jails across Washington State, there are dozens of men and women waiting behind bars for mental health evaluations. They've been charged with a crime, but they haven't been convicted. And the amount of time that they spend waiting can be weeks, in some cases months. These evaluations are called competency reviews. So what is a competency review? Emily Cooper, an attorney with Disability Rights Washington based in Seattle, says a medical professional asks a series of questions to determine whether someone is able to stand trial for the crime they're accused of committing.
Can you assist in your own defense? Do you understand the proceeding? Do you know who the judge is?
If the person is found to be of sound mind, then the case moves forward. If they fail, then the state is supposed to provide treatment.
It usually involves group therapy, medication, meeting with a social worker. And so that's how the process should work, and it should be a fairly streamlined process so that, again, the justice process can pick back up again.
Usually these people are in jail for minor infractions, trespassing, vagrancy. They haven't been convicted. And again, they're waiting for these evaluations to happen. This is what happened to Marilyn Roberts' son, Kevin. Kevin is bipolar. In 2014, he was 27 years old and living near Olympia.
He was to a point where he really wasn't cognizant of what was going on a day-to-day basis. And he actually contacted me one day and said, I'm going to get on the bus, which for me as a parent with someone who is not in full use of his faculties, headed off into downtown Olympia.
Kevin smokes cigarettes, and he lit up in a non-smoking area. He had some words with the transit staff, and then he left. But someone watching called the police.
And so when the police confronted him, they asked him to pull his hands out of his pocket and stop smoking. Well, he didn't figure he had to do that. He told him, no, I've left the property. I'm not going to do that. Well, they continued to pursue him. He actually went to flip his cigarette to put it out. Unfortunately, it looped around in the air, probably got caught by the wind, and hit the police officer in the brim of his cap, which was quite unfortunate at that moment because they took him down to the ground as an assault on the police officer.
Kevin was arrested and booked into the Thurston County Jail.
Within the first week of his stay there, he was assaulted by another inmate. And it happened to be while I was on the phone with him at my work. I work at a hospital in Olympia. And it was a pretty ugly moment in my life. I actually physically heard him being assaulted on the phone.
What exactly did you hear?
The phone hit the ground, a lot of screaming, leave me alone. And then, like, after 30 seconds, the phone hung up. And that sent complete and total panic through my heart. I got on the phone, called the jail back immediately. And all I heard from the jail guard was, if there was an issue, it will be dealt with.
Kevin eventually got a mental health evaluation. He was found incompetent to stand trial and was then put on the waiting list for a bed at Western State Hospital. His total time behind bars in the Thurston County Jail ended up being 97 days, which is more than the maximum sentence he could have received if he had simply been convicted. Marilyn, his mom, says even though she mailed her son's medication to the jail, it somehow never got to him. The jail says its policy is if an inmate has meds, they are administered, but they also said they can't force inmates to take their medication. Either way, as the days ticked by, Kevin's condition got steadily worse.
He was very delusional. He felt there was people in there with him. He would visualize things that weren't there. Birds. I remember a couple times he told me there was birds flying around in his cell. He has some eating issues. He would prefer to be a vegetarian. They fed him bologna sandwiches. So he wasn't eating a lot when he was in jail. He lost close to 40 pounds. That was one of my concerns with the jail folks. I'm like, he cannot withstand this type of weight loss for much longer. He needs to get out. He needs to get on his medication.
Kevin was eventually released to his family along with 16 packages of pills. Marilyn says none of them were opened. And Kevin did end up getting a bed at Western State Hospital. He got back on his meds and he got stable. The charges for flicking that cigarette at the police officer were never dropped. Instead of having the case go to trial, Kevin spent 2 years in a mental health court program, which tries to keep the mentally ill out of prison. And by doing this, he also had access to more services. Because of cases like Kevin's, in 2014, Emily Cooper with Disability Rights Washington says her organization, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, took the state to court.
What we were seeing in jails were our clients being placed in isolation. There are several county jails that have things called rubber rooms, which are these horrible, horrible rubber-coated rooms with a hole in the floor where they place the most vulnerable for weeks to months, force them to toilet in the hole in the floor in a suicide smock. I mean, it's just really, it's atrocities happening in our state because of the inability to have enough evaluations or evaluators to do the evaluations in beds when people need to go to the hospital for treatment.
Disability Rights Washington and the ACLU, they won the case. A federal judge agreed with the argument that making these men and women wait for such long periods of time was a violation of their constitutional rights.
So the judge said that the rights afforded to us under the Constitution are not subject to a price tag. She said the protections apply to everybody, including people with mental illness. And it's actually, when I read that line for the first time, I cried, which is not often that I do that, but it was like she completely got what we were trying to say, which is the Constitution shouldn't apply to some and not others.
What did she order the state to do?
She ordered the state to provide competency services within 7 days. Now, it's been appealed up to the Ninth Circuit, and it came back to the court. And so the standard now in Washington is that a competency evaluation has to happen within 14 days. And then if someone's been ordered to the hospital for restoration, they have to be admitted within 7 days. The 7 days also applies to people who are found particularly vulnerable in jail settings and ordered to the hospital for an inpatient evaluation.
Okay. Is that happening?
No. The state was found in contempt in July of last year and is being charged between $500 and $1,000 a day, every class member waiting over either 7 or 14 days. And right now, the contempt fines that the state has paid that are in the court's coffers exceed $12 million.
Disability Rights Washington has access to that money, and it's using it to create 5 pilot programs across the state. One of them is in Yakima.
So part of their grant will be towards having mental health ride-alongs, so mental health professionals who will ride along with police officers. So when they interact with someone with mental illness, say someone like Marilyn's son, you'll have a mental health professional there that will be able to potentially assess that person, determine if they are better to go into the mental health system rather than the criminal justice system. What we would like to see ideally is that they don't even go through that court process, that at the front door, truly, there's a recognition that this person's behavior is related to their disability and get treatment for that, that they don't even waste court dollars, county dollars, any dollars that are related to a punitive or corrective approach.
Washington's Department of Social and Health Services says it's doing its best to comply with the judge's orders. According to DSHS, the time people are waiting in jail for competency reviews is dropping, so is the wait time for a hospital bed. The state updates the court every month on what progress is being made. Meanwhile, Marilyn Roberts' son, Kevin, he graduates from his mental health court program in June, and after that, the charges for flicking a cigarette onto a police officer's cap will be erased from his record. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our show is about time. All of our lives are ruled by time, but some are more aware of it than others. At the Northwest Kidney Center in Seattle's First Hill neighborhood, dialysis patients are very aware of the passing hours. It's right on the screen of the machine that they're hooked up to, a machine that filters and cleans their blood, a job normally done by healthy kidneys.
We're in hour one. So I start at 5:30 to 10. And we have to be here half hour ahead in order to do the prep. And it depends on our blood pressure, whether we get on. And so today was okay. Yeah.
That's Seattle native Vanita McGee. She's in a big reclining chair covered by a gray blanket. She comes to the Northwest Kidney Center for dialysis 3 days a week for 4.5 hours at a time. Vanita's been in dialysis for 6 years because of end-stage renal failure. And from her chair, Vanita looks over at a row of other patients,
maybe a dozen or so people quietly sitting in the same reclining chairs next to their own humming and beeping machines. They all come here for hours at a time, several days a week, just to stay alive. But back in 2011, when Vanita's kidneys first stopped working, she didn't want this to be her life.
You know, they sent me to education, and my only question to them was, you know, well, what happens if you don't do it? And then finally they said, you die. And I said, oh, it don't seem that bad.
Death doesn't seem that bad.
Yeah. And so I decided not to go through this because I've, you know, I live my life and most of my people are gone.
But Vanita's friends convinced her to give it a try. The first 2 years were rough. She still worked full-time in social services. Today, she's on disability. The first time Vanita came to the dialysis center, she found it terribly depressing.
When I describe it, I say it's like a morgue, but we're not dead yet, you know? And my friends would come and they would, you know, check it out. So they were making sure that I got there. And so I had company. You know, I have my friends Stella and Mike. They come up once a week and we play cards. But I noticed a lot of people would just be like in their own private hells. So eventually what happened is like, you know, I was angry, I was mad. I didn't want to do this, you know, and I was having a hard time adjusting. And I said, well, I guess, you know, you can just suck on lemons or you can make lemonade out of lemons. So what I started to do is I started walking down the line after I got off and I'd start saying hello to everybody. Just, you know, hi, how are you doing? Have a good run.
Have a good run.
Yeah, they call our treatments runs. And it started off, the very first time it really started off was there was a woman on the second floor, and that's the very sick floor. And I was placed on there because of time. You know, because I worked so late, they shut down this floor early. So they moved me to the really, really severely sick floor. And she was in an isolation room, like one of these. These used to be isolation rooms. And she would always wail and cry and, you know, and it had a hard time calming her down. So I went in there and I sat next to her and I said my name and I held her hand and she stopped. She wanted some type of outreach, some type of human kindness, some type of touch. It got to be that I would kind of assist the second floor, because when she got out of control, I just go and sit and talk to her. And what I noticed sometimes is that people would tear up, or they would say thank you, or they would liven up, you know. And then when I got to this floor, I just started doing the little rounds and stuff. And I know that it helped me, because instead of me being focused on just going through this stuff, you know, I felt like I was sharing with another person, another human being. And then as I wound up and people started talking to me, they all have fascinating stories.
What are some of the stories you've heard here?
Well, one person, he just passed away. His whole family had congenital kidney disease. And so all these people that were blood related, they all died. And he knew he was dying, and I knew he was dying. But we lived every day, and one of his phrases was, well, we made it through another one, you know. Even when he went over to the other center, there's a whole bunch of centers around here. You know, I go and see him. He come and see me. He always give me all the political magazines, you know, and I just asked him one promise, is that when he pass, to please get word back to me, because when people here pass, because of the HIPAA laws, we don't know. We don't see him anymore. And so about 2 weeks ago, he got word to me before he died that he was going. We've built such a community that if one of us is not there in that chair, no matter if they don't know about HIPAA, they're asking, you know. And one good thing is that, you know, I've built some relationships here that we have each other's phone numbers and we talk outside of here. It's a lot different at this center than some other centers I've been to.
And you're responsible for that change in culture.
Well, I kind of pushed it along. You know, in 2011, on my birthday, I asked the nutritionist if I can give out sugar-free popsicles. And she said, yeah. And so I just started giving out sugar-free popsicles, and I gave a little party favors, which were little games from the dollar store. And it was a game that you had to have somebody else to play, you know? I mean, most people here, they want to get through this treatment and go home. And I don't blame them, you know? But now, you know, people, like I said, they step out beyond themselves. They laugh, they talk, they cry. And that's why it feels more like community.
Do you remember the moment when you realized, hey, I actually have created a community here?
I don't know when the moment is. It's just that it kind of just grew. Like Mrs. McClendon, coming to find out she likes opera and she likes classical music. So I found a way to get really cheap disability tickets. And then we, you know, dressed up and we went to opera. And we enjoy the concert and feel just like normal people, you know? And I know when it's community, when people want to do something out of this setting, you know? And my friend Laura, she's Mexican, right? And so when I first met her, I said hello, and she said, hola. And then she said, no, habla es inglés or whatever. I said, that's okay. I'll just come by, right? And so I think I kind of wore her down finally. She started talking English. Come to find out, she's a translator. I said, were you pulling my leg back then? You know, but she didn't know who I was. And she, you know, she ran in game, you know.
The people you've made friends with here, would you have gotten to know them outside of this place, do you think?
Actually, no. Mainly because the ages are different. Our lifestyles are different. You know, we're all here by happenstance. I feel, though, that I'm very fortunate in terms of this because, like I said, like I didn't want to do it. My friends cared enough about me to invest in me. They've been with me ever since. I have one friend, I call him Groucho because he looks like Groucho Marx. And every year he says, thank you for giving me one more year of life with you. I mean, I get emotional even thinking about it. And we're going up to 6 years now.
So how much time is left in your session now?
Well, till 10 o'clock. So we got about, 3 hours? It should tell you right there.
Remaining 2:48, 2 hours and 48 minutes.
Right.
Vanita and some of her fellow dialysis patients, friends she's made at the center, are planning to write a cookbook later this year for people with renal failure. Their diets can be pretty intense. And Vanita is also working to lose some weight so that she can get on the list for a kidney transplant. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme this week is It's About Time. So what do you do when you feel life's clock ticking? It's now or never, and you have to say something that you've never said out loud, and it's really important. Seattle writer and radio producer Dominic Black found himself in this exact situation. He shares this essay.
When I think back on it now, when I was growing up, there were two things that were really hard for me to tell my parents. And the first was, hey, Mom and Dad, we're getting sex education at school. And the second one was, I love you.
First off, I want to talk about this. I want to be clear about what exactly you want to hear.
So a bit of background. That's my dad in 1997. 2 years before he died.
Well, I can work clearly on this.
Yeah. That's the one time I tried to record my dad, and as you can tell, he wasn't entirely comfortable with the whole situation, which is fair enough. Right? We were sitting at the foot of the kitchen table at our house on the north coast of Ireland, and my mum is ironing in the background.
Hello, Dominic. How are you?
That's her. She had 12 kids. I'm number 10. I have two younger sisters.
When are you taking that beard off?
My beard was a perennial preoccupation for my mum. But getting her to talk was easy. She'd tell you she had nothing to say and then she'd go on for an hour.
What do you want me to tell you?
Right, well, tell me what you were going to tell me there.
You asked the question.
Right, well, how did you and Dad meet then?
Well, I was wanting to go to the tech to do short...
And she was full of mischief. She'd cheat at cards and then she'd deny it and then she'd say something like, you're not too old for a slap in the ear, you know, you cheeky article. But Dad was different. For one thing, he was born in 1916. He was 14 years older than Mum. And by the time I went to university in 1986, he was already 70 and still working. And then there was the vexing Irish question. Dad was careful about what he'd say and who he'd say it to. Growing up a Catholic in Northern Ireland, his experience and his father's experience taught him that saying the wrong thing could get you in trouble. The capital T troubles when I was growing up were a sort of constant background noise. 30-odd years of, what, civil war, I suppose, and troops in the streets. And so I'd go off on a teenage rant about Margaret Thatcher and something she'd done or something she'd said. And Mum and Dad's response was always, don't you be saying anything. Or, as the folk song from the time had it,
whatever you say, say nothing. When you speak about you know what, for if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you.
The only time I ever saw my dad cry was when his brother died. And I remember seeing him walking down the corridor in the hospital and tears were streaming down his face. And I'd never seen that before. And it was amazing. It was like he was revealed in a way that he'd never been to me before. This is our family eating dinner. Dad sat at the same place at the table every single mealtime, and he always had a half glass of milk with his dinner. He wore a tie most days. He was evangelical in his belief that a good education was the road to a decent life. And he said things like, Van Morrison, blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't go to the back door to see that fella. This was more his cup of tea. Count John McCormick, the famous Irish tenor, of whom Dad never tired of saying, he's a papal count, you know. Dad never once told me, I love you. He was a generation and a half distant from me, and he never had to say it. It probably never even occurred to him. I mean, it was evidenced by the roof over our heads and the groceries that were delivered in a cardboard box from McClister's every Friday night and in the colour TV that arrived one Saturday afternoon and in the money that was always somehow scraped together to pay for a school trip for one of my sisters or my first guitar, a black Harmony Sovereign with no bridge bought from Harry Mulholland for £50. So saying I love you, it didn't matter to my dad. It wasn't important at all to him. What mattered was what he did. At some point, though, the idea took root in my head that it was important for me to say I love you to him. And there's a whole lot of different reasons why that generational change happened. I mean, I've half a notion that it had something to do with the fact that we, when we were growing up, were living in cold, dark Northern Ireland, watching a lot of American TV, where the sun shone. And people said stuff like that. I mean, nobody where I came from said that. I mean, they say it now. Like, they say it all the time now. But somehow it became important to name the emotions that you're feeling in a way that was unthinkable a generation before, or unnecessary. So anyway, fast forward a few years. I'm 30 years old. I'm going back to Scotland after the Christmas holidays. I was living in Scotland at that time. And Dad's given me a lift back to the boat. It's 6:30 in the morning. It's cold and damp, and I'm hungover. And we get to the ferry terminal. I did this journey a lot, and that ferry terminal is engraved in my brain. I mean, I can summon up a picture of that place, and I feel almost like I'm back there. And we're having a cup of tea. We're sitting in these white plastic chairs. Then the shop shutter behind us rattles open, and I go in and I buy the papers, a Guardian for me and the Irish News for Dad. And then it's time for me to get going. So I gather up my stuff, and we make our way over to the line where I'll go through security. And as usual, I'm never quite sure whether me and Dad are going to hug or we're going to shake hands or what. So we do this odd little shimmy, and then we do a wee bit of both. It's like a half hug, half shake hands, and he slips a £20 note into my hand, which is something he always did. "Buy yourself something on the boat," he says. "Thanks, Dad. Thanks for driving me." "Ah, sure, it gets me up for mass." And then at the age of 30, I say it at last. "I love you, Dad." And he sort of makes this strange little sound, like a "Arr!" And he sort of laughs and says, "Same to you." And away he goes, off through the sliding doors and back up the coast road to home and a cup of tea and 10 o'clock mass. And I go through security and up the escalator and onto the boat. My mum, by the way, when I eventually got up the courage to say to her, "I love you," just said, "Aye. Well, sure, why wouldn't you?"
That was sound effect contributor and Seattle writer Dominic Black. This brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for spending time with us. Sound effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom gets the word out on social media. Special thanks this week goes out to Heba Fisher and Dominic Black. Our intern is Amanda Abbott. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app, and you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week when our theme is Liar, Liar.
It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll in 1910. She's really bending the mold of what's possible.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.